This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm very happy to be back here. I've missed you all very much. I appreciate your coming back to see us. We have a very interesting evening tonight, and I'm going to help put it in context. There'll be two readings, one by Brian Turner first, and then by Bruce Weigel. I'm going to be doing their introductions now, so remember that when Bruce Weigel appears, you've already heard about him, okay? When I heard that the Lannans were going to be doing an evening that would have to do with war poetry, I immediately heard, being a child of the 60s, anti-war poetry. And I thought, well, isn't that the only kind there is, really? And then I realized, oh, no. In fact, you know, Homer, the Iliad, the extraordinary battle poetry in the Old Testament, that before we had anti-war poetry, we had war poetry. We don't think of this because we don't think of our culture celebrating war. Those of us who read poetry tend not to be in favor of war. And so we forget that part of what we have learned about war, both its terrors and its effect on a culture, is from poets. And if we were still being taught Greek and Latin, we'd be reading the Gallic Wars and, my favorite word, the Peloponnesian Wars, and we'd be realizing that movies like The Warriors are based on Xenophon, that there's a whole culture that we don't know. When a war comes along, why are we disorganized in our response? Because we've lost track of the history of war in our hemisphere, in our culture. During the Civil War, there were not only songs being written about the war on both sides, but a good deal of war poetry by people as various as Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. And not just on one side. You know, we've become a culture so frightened by confrontation that we forget that during the Civil War, it wasn't just the abolitionists. There were people, honorable people, intellectuals even, speaking of the importance of slavery as the basis for the American economy. World War I has the beginning of the poems that we know about the death of youth. And if you've never read, for instance, Ezra Pound's tribute at the death of the great sculptor and artist Gordia Breshka, the recognition that we lose culture in a war, that we lose our knowledge of our own futures, that the people who are sent to war were called the flower of our youth. And then when we grew more distrustful, we said that we didn't want to turn our youth into cannon fodder. Do you know what cannon fodder is? You know, it's the pile of debris and ash, you know, after the shooting of a cannon. And so we go into World War II, and by now war has become, in a certain sense, an occasion for poets who've trained themselves. They were waiting to use their voices, to use their training as poets, to speak to the lives of culture, pro and con. And when we think about Paul Celan was an ordinary German poet until meeting the Holocaust, he determined that German was no longer a language that deserves poetry. And although he was a German poet, he would write from henceforth only in a broken German. I remember then, we're moving to Vietnam, that when I was a young man, they would close Fifth Avenue down to traffic on Saturdays, and there were war protests, but there were more than that. There were people who were in favor of the war. I remember once that a man removed his glass eye and held it up at us and said, "Are you going to tell me that this means nothing?" And I remember thinking, this is a real question. No, it doesn't mean nothing, but I don't know what it does mean anymore. It's no longer clear what this prosthesis means. Now, tonight we have two poets. It's a very interesting circumstance. Brian Turner is a poet who went to school. Both his father and his grandfather served in various branches of the armed services. This is a man who enlisted. He was sent to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then after the 9/11 attacks, he was sent to Iraq. The question came up, do I go? Both he and his family agreed that they did not support this war. He went because the alternatives were to move to Australia or to go to jail. Neither of them were his preference. The idea of a poet, as I understand it, he began as an anti-war poet, but it's an unusual kind of anti-war poetry. It was anti-war on drugs poetry. It was a book that he wrote in graduate school. It was never published. Then he wrote a book of poems about Bosnia and his experiences there. And then after he came back from Iraq, he published this book, Here Bullet, his first book. He's also been writing on the Home Fires blog for the New York Times. There was a month worth of blogs, and there have been poems that have appeared since. But Here Bullet is his first and only book so far, published by a small press, Alice James. And that's another thing to understand, that in our time, poetry of this sort has become the province of the small press. If you support poetry and you are not getting books from small presses in America, you're not supporting poetry. This is where poets write, develop their careers. When I called Alice James and said I'd be talking to Brian, we had an hour conversation. They told me about the other books they publish and why they do what they do up there. You know, this is a hard life. No one who's going to be a poet knows what his future will hold. Often people who become poets may enlist because it seems to offer a stabilization to the future. I was talking to the chairman of one of the most respected, probably the most respected programs in the country, Iowa, Jim Galvin, who told me that one of his students there has a mother who is homeless and who lives on the streets. And he sends part of his stipend to his mother. And Galvin says, this kid comes to us from Harvard. We're so lucky to have him. And he is choosing not to go to business school. He believes in poetry. He believes somehow that the role of a poet will stay alive. You have to understand, we're living in desperate times, and this form of statement may be the only truth we hear. Here Bullet is not a partisan book. It talks about deaths on both sides and opens the door. There are quotes in it from the Quran, from Iraqi poetry today. There's a beautiful poem that descends from the Epic of Gilgamesh. we are returning to the past and to culture. When you hear that they are bombing the Tigris and Euphrates, understand that they are bombing the cradle of civilization, and look around you and ask what's happening to civilization in our time. We are bombing the cradle of civilization. Our second poet is Bruce Weigel, who is to me an extraordinary figure. He enlisted and was sent to Vietnam, and it was from his experience there that he decided to be a poet. When you read Bruce Weigel's poetry, you're watching something extraordinary happening, because the first books are the books of someone who is something of a disgruntled and wild absurdist, feeling, as many people who felt who served in Vietnam, that life itself had become senseless. When he came back, and after he'd published his first three books, perhaps culminating in his most famous book, Song of Napalm, he went back to Vietnam and began speaking to people who had also been tortured or had their families killed on the other side. And he began writing a kind of witness poetry that witnesses on both sides, understanding we're moving from that idea of glorious poetry to an anti-war poetry to the poetry of witness that says we must not forget. Accompanying that movement was the extraordinary anthology put together by Carolyn Forché called Against Forgetting. One of the most extraordinary things to my mind that Bruce Weigel did was to get poems from captured documents. These were poems that were written by people fighting with the North Vietnamese against the Americans. They wrote poetry because in Vietnam, as it is said again and again, whenever you read translations of Vietnamese poetry, everyone writes poetry. It is part of the tradition. These were journals and poems that were taken from battlefields and kept for, what was it, nearly 20 years by the American intelligence. And he arranged for these to be translated, published, co-translated. So we began to hear the voices that told us that war is good for none of us. But there are people in that book of Vietnamese, North Vietnamese poetry, a people who can celebrate their war because they're fighting for their land. Both of these poets are talking to us about wars that, famously, we are still not sure why we participate in. The poets are not trying to tell us what to think or feel. They're trying to remind us that poetry is best at capturing those moments that emerge from the smoke and blur of the pain of life, so that war and poetry have held hands for many, many centuries. We are here to hear what they have to tell us and to be grateful that we are still in a culture that has enabled us to hear such a message that we are still being told by our poets. Thank you very much. And the first... the first reader is Brian Turner.
Here, bullet, if a body is what you want, then here is bone and gristle and flesh. Here is the clavicle-snapped wish, the aorta's open valves, the leap thought makes at the synaptic gap. Here is the adrenaline rush you crave, that inexorable flight, that insane puncture into heat and blood. And I dare you to finish what you've started, because here, bullet, here is where I complete the word you bring, hissing through the air. Here is where I moan the barrel's cold esophagus, triggering my tongue's explosives for the rifling I have inside of me. Each twist of the round spun deeper. Because here, bullet, here is where the world ends every time. I wrote that poem in February of 2004, and I read it everywhere I go, and it's still kind of a mystery to me, which I think is a good thing. You know, sometimes when you read poems, I think it's good that you want to come back to them, because maybe for me it's a source where maybe I can still learn about myself and what was happening to me at that time, kind of thing. But I folded it up at the time, I put it in a Ziploc bag, and I put it in my pocket, and I carried it with me the rest of the time that I was in country, which was from... We initially went in country the 3rd of December 2003, crossed the border in Kuwait and convoyed up past Baghdad. And then we stayed there for a couple of months in a small town called Balad, which you sometimes see in the news. And then we moved up to Mosul or Mosul. Both pronunciations are correct. But we stayed, and that's in the northern part of Iraq. And we stayed there for a couple more months. And in the middle of 2004, we were sent down south to Baghdad, where we lived north and south of the city daily. So we'd wake up, escort a convoy of trucks through the city, sleep, and then do the same thing back over and over until we were replaced, went back up to Mosul and finished out our time. And tonight, I want to thank you for having me here so that I can read these poems. And maybe to give an idea of where they are, the first half of the poems that I'd like to read they're from this book, and they were written while I was there. And then the second half, roughly, will be new poems that I'm writing on the same theme, but from here, which is very different. So, how are you guys all doing tonight? Everybody okay? Yeah? There's going to be some bummer stuff coming here tonight, so sit back, brace yourself, you know? So, this poem is called 2,000 Pounds, and it's set in a traffic circle, which is a very common feature in a lot of countries in the Middle East and in Iraq as well. In the major cities, you'll see these. And it seemed to me an inclusive place to sort of investigate what happens as a bomb goes off. So it tries verse stanza by verse stanza to kind of look around that traffic circle and see what's happening in that moment. So hopefully that'll make sense. It begins simply with a fist, white-knuckled and tight, glossy with sweat. With two eyes in a rearview mirror watching for a convoy. The radio, a soundtrack that adrenaline has pushed into silence, replacing it with a heartbeat, his thumb trembling over the button. A flight of gold, that's what Cefwan thinks, as he lights a Miami, draws in the smoke, and waits in his taxi at the traffic circle. He thinks of summer, 1974, lifting pitchforks of grain high in the air, the slow drift of it like the fall of Shatha's hair. And although it was decades ago, he still loves her, remembers her standing at the canebrake where the buffalo cooled shoulder deep in the water, pleased with the orange cups of flowers he brought her. And he regrets how so much can go wrong in a life, how easily the years slip by, light as grain, bright as the street's concussion of metal, shrapnel traveling at the speed of sound to open him up in blood and shock, a man whose last thoughts are of love and wreckage, with no one there to whisper him gone. Sergeant Ledoux of the National Guard speaks but cannot hear the words coming out. And it's just as well his eardrums have ruptured because it lends the world a certain calm. Though the traffic circle is filled with people running in panic, their legs a blur like horses in a carousel, turning and turning the way the tires spin on the Humvee flipped to its side, the gunner's hatch he was thrown from, a mystery to him now, a dark hole in metal the color of sand. And if he could, he would crawl back inside of it. And though his fingertips scratch at the asphalt, he hasn't the strength to move. Shrapnel has torn into his ribcage, and he will bleed to death in minutes. But he finds himself surrounded by a strange beauty, the shine of light on the broken, a woman's hand touching his face tenderly the way his wife might, amazed to find a wedding ring on his crushed hand, the bright gold sinking in flesh, going to bone. Rashid passes the bridal shop on a bicycle with Sefa beside him. And just before the air ruckles and breaks, he glimpses the sidewalk reflections in the storefront glass. Men and women walking and talking or not. An instant of clarity just before each of them shatters under the detonation's wave, as if even the idea of them were being completely destroyed, stripped of form. The blast tearing into the mannequins who stood as though husband and wife a moment before, who cannot touch one another, who cannot kiss, who now lie together in glass and debris, holding one another in their half-armed embrace and calling this love, if this is all there will ever be. The civil affairs officer, Lieutenant Jackson, stares at his missing hands, which make no sense, no sense at all, to wave these absurd stumps held in the air where just a moment before he'd blown bubbles out the Humvee window, his left hand holding the bottle, his right hand dipping the plastic ring in soap, filling the air behind them with floating spheres like the oxygen trails of deep ocean divers. Something for the children, something beautiful, translucent globes with their iridescent skins drifting on vehicle exhaust in the breeze that might lift one day over the Zagros Mountains. That kind of hope. Small globes which may have astonished someone on the sidewalk 7 minutes before Lieutenant Jackson blacks out from blood loss and shock, with no one there to bandage the wounds that would carry him all the way home. Nearby, an old woman cradles her grandson, whispering, rocking him on her knees as though singing him to sleep, her hands wet with their blood, her black dress soaked in it as her legs give out and she buckles with him to the ground. If you'd asked her 40 years earlier if she could see herself, an old woman begging by the roadside for money, here, with a bomb exploding at the market among all these people, she'd have said, to have your heart broken one last time before dying, to kiss a child given sight of a life he could never live, it's impossible. This isn't the way we die. And the man who triggered the button, who may have invoked the prophet's name or not, he is obliterated at the epicenter. He is everywhere. He is of all things. His touch is the air taken in, the blast and the wave, the electricity of shock. His is the sound the heart makes quick in the panic's rush, the surge of blood searching for light and color. That sound the martyr cries, filled with the word his soul is made of, Inshallah! But still hanging in the air over Asher Square, the telephone line snapped in two, crackling a strange incantation the dead hear, as they wander confused amongst one another, trying to learn each other's names, trying to comfort the living in their grief, to console those who cannot accept such random pain, speaking Habib softly, one to another there in the rubble and debris, Habib, over and over, that it might not be forgotten. And Habib is a word for love, right? So, yeah. No, it's cool. It's odd that some of the things that that we touch on. Sometimes when I hear clapping, and don't take this wrong, but if you hear clapping off in the distance, when there's a firefight off in the distance, sometimes it's kind of close to the sound of weapons off in the distance when they're shooting, small arms fire, a little bit. I don't know. So tonight is cool. Don't worry, I'm not going to drop and roll or, you know, start, you know. But I'm just, you know. I'll just read some poems, and maybe at the end we can all clap. Bruce is coming up, and I'm looking forward to reading. And so this is an interesting tandem. We got to read in Chicago as well, so I'm looking forward to tonight because he's got so many things up his sleeve. I don't know what we'll hear. I'm just looking forward to it. But I'm going to read a poem called, and it's a sex poem, so little something to juice us up a bit. But I don't think it'll be cool, so we'll see. It's called Last Night's Dream, and it's for the goddess Ishtar, goddess of love and war. In the dream, her breasts become confused in my lips. I shoot an azimuth to her navel while her fingertips touch me with concussions, as if explosives rang through the nerves of my body, as if I am strung with wire, a huge receiver of UHF radio transmissions, frequency hopping with our tongues as we kiss, and I slide into her with a sound of flashbang grenades that make her eyes cloud over and smoke from the heat of it. In the dream, she kisses Arabic into my skin, and I understand every word of it. I transcribe it backwards into cuneiform and stone. I rename the arteries and veins for every river and wadi from Dohuk North to Basra South. I feel for this geography of pleasure. My tongue is a marker that writes even in the rain, even in salt and sweat, and I write with it now over every curve and turn of her body. In the dream, our orgasm destroys a nation. It leaves thermite and gunpowder in the air above us, a crackling of radio static as we kiss on, long into the denouement of skin and fire, where medevac helicopters fly in the dark caverns of our lungs in search of the wounded, and we breathe them. One to another, a deep rotor wash of pain and bandages. This next poem actually has Santa Fe shows up in here. This is my first time to Santa Fe, but when I was writing this, I was in Iraq, and I was like, Santa Fe, you know? That's got to show up. So it shows up briefly. It's one of those catalog poems that has different parts of the country kind of show up in it. But I wrote, it was one of the rare poems I wrote while sort of thinking back to America. I usually didn't allow myself to do this. I tried to stay focused on where I was and not sort of think back home. This was written in Almabadi, Iraq, just about 20 kilometers southeast of Mosul. It's called Cole's Guitar. And the only other thing is, late at night, there was this medic that I didn't get along with at all. I thought he was really lazy. I always thought he was lazy. And I play bass in a band. But I didn't know this connection until 2, 3 in the morning. I hear this guitar off in the distance. I didn't even know he had a guitar. It was down at the aid station. So I walked down there, and after that, we became friends, you know? Music has a way of doing that. Cole's Guitar. It's the sound from the aid station that wakes me. Thin steel from Doc Cole's six-string. A 4 a.m. sound of sour whiskey, heroin, and sex, and dying. That's the sound I'm hearing now. Slow as smoke from a factory in Pittsburgh. Slow as a needle in a vein. Slow as steam off the bath or a lover with only the blues to sing. I'm hearing America now. I'm hearing Jake breaks off the grapevine. County highways with wheat shocks and Indian summer grass whispering. Foghorns under the Golden Gate Bridge. Ella Fitzgerald from a fourth floor window in Birmingham. The handles of a suitcase swinging on the downbeat of a man's footsteps walking out from a Greyhound in Santa Fe. I'm in Wyoming. I'm in New York. I'm leaning in to kiss a woman in the cornfields down by the river. I'm with children drawing portraits in the sand, old men watching fireflies the way Muhammad Ali lay on the canvas and dreamed. That's what I'm hearing, the wind on the redwood coast, old as the ocean and hushed by sheets of fallen snow. Palm mute the strings, Doc. Strum that song until I can see the breath on a bus window, the faces of strangers in the rain, my own hands tracing the features of every one of them, the way ghosts might visit the ones they love, as I am now, listening to America, touching the cold glass. And I'll read one last poem from when I was in Iraq. And I read this everywhere I go. I read it in Germany with a guy translating it for me in German, because I don't speak German fluently enough. And it sounded like the right rhythm. You know, we practiced it together and read it together and stuff, but the reason I read it is because if there's anything else that, if you forget everything that my part of this night, that's fine. But this one poem would be an honor if you would remember this. Because when my unit came back, we were on a parade field, and it was a sunny day, and it was a large field. There's about 3,500 of us out there in our best uniforms, all clean and stuff. And the general of the post was out there, and all the brass and stuff in the stands, and there were reporters and balloons and stuff. It was a sort of welcome back, official ceremony welcoming us back. And at one point, the colonel gave, as he was giving a speech, he asked for a moment of silence. He's listed the names of those who did not come back with us. And as he completed the list, I realized that he didn't say the name of Private Miller, Private First Class Bruce Miller. And I don't know that colonel. I don't know why he didn't, you know, say that. I have never been able to meet him. Maybe someday I'll understand. But it felt to me like maybe it was because he didn't die what might be considered a soldier's death. So he didn't make that role, you know. But to me, that seemed a fundamental injustice to an American who put their hand up and went overseas on our behalf. And you'll see in the poem. It's called Eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west, though burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils, the way piano wire thrums when given slack, and it happens like this. On a blue day of sun, when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth. The sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees. And nothing can stop it now. No matter what blur of motion surrounds him, no matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is down in the eucalyptus shade there by the river. He was 23. He was a kind of a sweet kid, you know, as far as I didn't know him real well. He was in second squad, Bravo team, and I was in the third squad, Alpha team. And we lived, ate, you know, broke bread and all that kind of stuff for about a year and a half. different soldiers came and went, but he and I had worked together for quite a while. And he was real quiet. He always played those little handheld video games and stuff. And he seemed kind of like a young soul. He's 23, but he always seemed like 18, 19, one of those kind of kids. All right. So I'm going to read a couple poems, one for Bruce. I think I see you out there. So I'd like to read one for you. And your influence is here, but it's not lifted up as high as it should be, you know, but I'm trying, you know. And it's called Waiting Out in Al-Daluya, Iraq. We're crossing an open field, sweating in December's heat, with first squad covering from the brush to our left. And I could be shot dead by a sniper easily. This could be the ground where I bleed out in 90 seconds, but it won't be. There's a patch of still water I'm about to walk into, as I always do, with too much adrenaline and momentum in my stride, my boots sinking ankle deep, and still I slog forward, M4 held up over my head. And though Fiorillo sinks up to his knees off to my right, he backs up, makes it out of the septic runoff I'm about up to my thighs in, the stench filling my nostrils now. And it's funny enough to laugh at once the mission's over, Turner running in to swim, but no one's laughing anymore. And the months are turning into years gone by, and still I'm down there slogging deeper into the shit, shoulder deep. My old platoon with another year of bullets and mortars and missions dragging them further in. My lieutenant so far down I can't reach him anymore. My squad leader hunting for the souls that would mark him and drag him under completely, better than any bottle of whiskey. And I keep telling myself that if I walk far enough or long enough, someday I'll walk out on the other side. But will Jax and Bosch and my lieutenant make it out too? If one day we find ourselves poolside in California, the day as bright as this one, how will we hose ourselves off to remove the stench, standing around a barbecue, talking football? How do we do that? I read two short poems after this. One's called Guarding the Bomber. If you read the Quran, I read it in translation, so I'm not an expert or anything in the Quran, but I read it when I was in college, and I read it again prior to going to Iraq, and then some after. But at one point in there, it's kind of confusing, because at one point there it says that there are 19 angels over this pit of hell where the condemned kind of go, and they're guarding them, keeping them in there, you know. But it says the number is unknowable, and that people argue about the number. You know, so I'm confused about that part. But it fascinated me that there was this idea of this pit of hell, and that there would be angels there to sort of guard over them. And it reminded me, in an odd way, when I was in Iraq, there was a guy in Mosul who had tried to build this bomb in his house, and he screwed up and he blew himself up, and he lost all four limbs of his body. You know, and these stumps were like, you know, he was bandaged. They were trying to care for him, and he was in a. We had these sort of trailers that we lived in. He was in one right behind ours. A medic would go in and take care of him during the day, and there was a guard that had to guard him 24 hours a day. I always thought, he can't even move. How's he, you know, what's he going to do exactly, you know? But he had to have a guard there, and probably for his own good, I would think, maybe, you know. Hopefully that was the reason, you know, from some other person on the camp, you know. But this poem comes from that. It's called Guarding the Bomber. With his legs gone, bandaged at mid-femur, his palms, he palms the invisible above him like a conductor in difficult passages of light, fluorescent and streaming. Two gauze-wrapped stumps directing movement from his shoulders as I wipe salt from his lips with a wet rag, checking the feeding tube, the IV in his neck, listening to his morphined Arabic as I imagine him lying there in the debris and settling dust, his brain snapping back into momentary consciousness, realizing that his own feet, still in their sandals, wait for him across the room, and that his hands, driven beyond the body, negotiate black wires and hot wires still, arming explosives in 155-millimeter shell casing. Much of his body unable to sweat, working here beyond me and my thoughts of his paradise, wondering if the virgins will care for him as I do, changing his bedpan, bathing him with sponges and reassurances in English, a language he hates, its vowels a smooth sheen of oil on steel. No, he's far beyond my rifle and desert fatigues, his ghost limbs dexterous and agile. And whether I want to admit it or not, he's tending the fire, the explosives continuing around him. His arms are elbow deep in the blue flame and heat, reaching down to touch me. And a last poem. You guys have a farmer's market down the road, right? I saw you have a winter market, and then I guess you have another one because it's cold. You guys go indoors? And then I'm guessing there must be an outdoor one too, right? Yeah, and this one is pretty, you know, most towns have like sort of a farmer's market called Saturday Market. This poem started out being called Saturday Market, but now it's called at the Farmer's Market in Eugene, Oregon. Behind the storefront glass, a television set broadcasts a familiar scene. A woman with fists knuckling white, her mouth shocked open as if wailing, or at the dry end of wailing. Though no one hears it, no one notices her face framed in a black abaya, eyes lined in charcoal, the color of the shadows trailing behind us as we pass by, arms filled with bags of cauliflower, ossified heads. In the farmer's market, each stall overflows with artichoke hearts, tangelos, mandarin oranges. Ladyfinger grapes slip from the palms of the dead, whose hands fill the stacked boxes, among spears of asparagus, the missing limbs of the wounded, pickled radishes and ketchup jars shelved like pints of blood left open behind the vendors. And the woman in the television, she stares at the incomprehensible sunflowers, honey from Volcano Island, skins of avocados hardening into hand grenades. She sees how veterans kiss their wives with the taste of bullets on their tongues, as sparrows and finches sing in the birches above the children, a choir for the dead who have traveled so far to be here among us. Here, where the fountain shoots a crude and oily stream for the bright coins of lovers who make their wishes and don't look back. No one notices this woman in the television, the wreckage surrounding her, the smoldering and twisted metal. Though if I just stopped for a moment here in front of her, I might feel the heat blowing past her and into the street. I might smell what no one should ever smell, holding her with my arms to shield her from the wild trajectories of bullets, the crackling applause of white phosphorus as it bursts into fireworks over the local football game. And the old man with a saxophone might put down his horn as dazed shoppers exit the storefronts, their eardrums ringing, everything they touch given the fingerprint of blood, and art the small children duplicate on the sidewalks, where I hold this woman and guide her to the nearby grass, easing her down into the contrails of fighter jets banking in the curve of another bombing run. As I whisper words that mean nothing to her, my face a dark shadow eclipsing the sun, my hair on fire with it, the words in my mouth falling around her like spent shell casings of brass, while someone yells nearby for people to run back inside, get T-shirts, tampons, anything to stop the bleeding. Thank you very much for having me here. It's an honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian, for your service and for your brave poems. I have a great deal to be grateful for tonight. But if I told you all the things I'm grateful for, there would be no time for any of the poems. So I'm especially grateful for the opportunity to be here with you tonight and to say thank you to the Lannan family and the Lannan Foundation for their enormously generous support of writers, and especially this writer. I would be lying if I said that the money didn't matter. Of course, the money's nice. The money makes everything easier. But at this point in my writing life, I'm 59 years old, it was more the gesture, the blessing of the Lannan family and the Lannan Foundation that meant so much to me. The enabling gesture of saying, we believe in your work. So I'll forever be grateful for that. Thank you. I'm going to do a little bit of a hodgepodge reading. I've been doing this for a long time, so I want to give you a little bit of an idea of 30 years of writing. I also want to thank Michael for that tremendous introduction. This is called Song of Napalm. After the storm, After the rain stopped pounding, we stood in the doorway watching horses walk off lazily across the pasture's hill. We stared through the black screen, our vision altered by the distance, so I thought I saw a mist kicked up around their hooves when they faded like cutout horses away from us. The grass was never more blue in that light, more scarlet. Beyond the pasture, trees scraped their voices into the wind. Branches crisscrossed the sky like barbed wire, but you said they were only branches. Okay. The storm stopped pounding. I'm trying to say this straight. For once, I was sane enough to pause and breathe outside my wild plans, and after the hard rain, I turned my back on the old curses. I believed they swung finally away from me. But still the branches are wire and thunder is the pounding mortar. Still I close my eyes and see the girl running from her village, napalm stuck to her dress like jelly, her hands reaching for the no one who waits in waves of heat before her. So I can keep on living. So I can stay here beside you. I try to imagine she runs down the road and wings beat inside her until she rises above the stinking jungle and her pain eases in your pain and mine. But the lie swings back again. The lie works only as long as it takes to speak, and the girl runs only as far as the napalm allows until her burning tendons and crackling muscles draw her up into that final position, burning body so perfectly assume. Nothing can change that. She's burned behind my eyes, and not your good love, and not the rain-swept air, and not the jungle green pasture unfolding before us can deny it. Thank you. It's called The Kiss. All the goodbyes said and done, I climbed into the plane and sat down. From the cold, I was shaking and ached to be away from the love of those waving through the frozen window. Once as a boy, I was lost in a storm, funnel cloud twisting so near I was pitched from my bicycle into the ditch, picked up by the wind and yellow sky, my arms before me, feeling my way through the wind I could not cry above. Out of that black air of debris, out of nowhere, my father bent down and lifted me and ran to the house of some strangers. And again, that day on the plane, he appeared to me, my forgotten orders in his hands. He bent down and put the envelope into my hand. On my lips, he kissed me hard, and without a word, he was gone into the cold again. Through the jungle, through the highlands, through all that green dying, I touched my fingers to my lips. This is called Elegy. Into sunlight they marched, into dog day, into no saints day, and were cut down. They marched without knowing how the air would be sucked from their lungs, how their lungs would collapse, how the world would twist itself, would bend into the cruel angles. Into the black understanding they marched until the angels came, calling their names, until they rose one by one from the blood. The light blasted down on them. The bullets sliced through the razor grass so there was not even time to speak. The words would not let themselves be spoken. Some of them died. Some of them were not allowed to die. I hope this is not a too feeble attempt to lighten it up just a little bit. But I want to read a poem that I wrote for all of those who struggled in math class, believe it or not. Are you out? Yeah. There. It's called The Unknowns. If only they had told us that it was all a metaphor, I might have learned. I might not have troubled so long tonight over equations my daughter has brought home from school, her mother gone somewhere, and me her only chance at the quantities. When I ask her if she thinks there are numbers to measure loss, or to measure grief, she wonders out loud what we would do with those sums once we had untangled them from their drowsy abstractions. Mr. Brown was my teacher of the sums in the sixth grade, and he saw the beautiful figures in everything. So he grieved over my unlearning, cudgeled me daffy with his slide rule, and took on as his fate my crummy well-being. I wanted to please him, so I cheated more than once. Although that was neither the new nor the old math, only a thing I had imagined, I invented. I cheated, and I copied, and I asked some girls to do my work so I could watch the grief leave the face of Mr. Brown when I showed him my solutions that were mine only in abstraction, only because I possessed them. Thank you. I'm reading from a book called The Unraveling Strangeness, and this is the last poem in that book. It's called Meeting Mr. Death. You could say I kept my cool when I met Mr. Death. I even made him laugh by offering my hand to shake in the bullet-torn morning hours. And then I said, are you looking at me? And he got the joke. Death gets the joke, or else our whole lives are a lie and a waste. He didn't take my hand, but he laughed at my jokes, and he made me feel welcome inside the grace he still wore, shawl of the ghostly angel he had been but could no longer remember. Mr. Death, he was hanging around some pals of mine, some boys of the unspeakable rapture of war. He could have had me that morning, too, when I looked away to the monsoon-heavy river where the bodies had come to rest in the last eddies, but he changed his mind. The last book I published a couple years ago is called Declension in the Village of Chunglung. And I have a daughter whose name is Nguyen Thi Hang. Hang is her first name. And this is a village. She's from Vietnam. My wife and I adopted her when she was 8 years old. She's now 20 and a pre-med student at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. Chunglung is a very poor and very beautiful place. And I was always struck when I went there, and I've been there many times, by that paradox. So I use that to sort of guide me through this book. I think it has a lot to do with empires and empires falling and crumbling, including our own. I want to read a few poems from this collection. This is one of those books where when I close it, the poems move around inside. So, excuse me. This is called Eddie. My friend Eddie had a younger brother who definitely had something fucked up in his brain. Eddie's mother prayed out loud all day in her bedroom, lit with candles. I never heard his solemn steel mill father utter one single syllable. Not ever. Because no one else would. I loved Eddie. I went to his house where other children feared to go. I heard his mother pray and weep so loud I almost ran away until Eddie held my wrist and said to take it slow. I didn't know then what immaculate beauties I was among. We tried to teach his brother how to use a fork and spoon, how to zip his fly and pee like a man, how to swing the bat, but he never learned, and I didn't know then that love could be about two boys like that, or that what Eddie held fast before the waves of prayer and the stony father's silence and the world's infinite indignities is called brother, and that what he gave up is called everything. I was blessed, as a writer anyway, to grow up among working class people. In a working-class community. And one of the things that you probably know about working-class people is they'll never pick up the phone to call anyone else to fix anything. They insist on doing it themselves. Sometimes to, great tragedy and confusion. And this is a poem about one of those times. It's called My Uncle Rudy in Sunlight. Out of the hole my father and his brother had dug below the drainage tiles of my uncle's barn, hundreds of mice streamed. These brothers had dug the hole, then snaked a hose deep into the nest the mice had made, and no way out but one. They had started getting bad, and when my aunt found them in her pantry, well, something had to be done. I was 5 years old, and I stood behind these brave men and watched between their legs as the mice began to come. First, only a few, shaking the water from their fur, blinded momentarily in the sunlight. And then, may I say, a flood of mice. More mice than anyone had expected. Even I knew that. My uncle had a hoe, and my father ran for the rake, and you know what happens next. This was 50 years ago, and I don't know what business it thinks it has here in this life now. Yet in the dizzying span of memory, that morning in the country of mice is as clear to me as my own face, which I love, and as clear as the face of my uncle moving in and out of the blinding sun as he raised the hoe and then came down hard and then raised the hoe again. The 1,000th. We watched the 1,000th dead soldier's face on the color television with a flat screen so that no matter where you sat, you saw him face to face. With the promise of the liars on his lips, he died in the liars' war. To die alone in the desert, far from home, far from the people who love you, is not ever a glorious thing, and I don't give a fuck what my government says otherwise. Sacrifice and slaughter are not the same things. The sorrowful Red Star mothers will come out of their houses to tell you that in the 1,000 languages from the 1,000 cities and the 1,000 torn hearts. And what do we say to them? And what do we say to the faces we see in our own mirrors, the ones who still want answers even as we turn away? Thank you. This is called Apology to No One, November 17th, 2004. I didn't stop to consider the sociological implications before I acted or before I spoke out. Someone at the academic party said vis-a-vis, and I lost it. I fell into a beautiful flashback, man. Rockets that sound like trains through the night sky, but that was that. More or less instantaneous so that no one noticed I had left and then come back. You don't have to tell me a thing or two about portals. There's the talk, and then there's the talk about the talk. And isn't this romantic? To love words and the sounds of words, even as the bodies pile up in secret, even as the children are terrorized out of their minds by bombs we pay for, you can only cover your mouth so you don't scream out loud. And the last poem in this book is called My Goodbye. The mermaids do not sing for anyone, not even for themselves. They sing because they do, because the wind blows through them in a way that makes them call out what sounds like desire. We only imagine that they sing for us so that we may have someone to blame when we crash into the rocks. White birds, you call the egrets from the bridge on Hampton Roads. All those white birds like the dead come home from their green dying inside the perfectly shaped bodies of egrets. We wanted to see the splendor we could feel, so we drove the rental car out into a virgin stand of hemlock trees, the dusk like lace curtains settling. The dogs, in my mind, I live among. That's my goodbye. Thank you. Now I'm very excited to read from a new manuscript that was written during the time that I was afforded thanks to the support of the Lannan Foundation. So these are Lannan poems. I hope they are good enough. This is a poem I wrote for a boy who was killed in Iraq, a boy from my hometown, Lorain, Ohio. It's called This Boy. This president, this murder factory, this bombing protocol, this stunning ignorance, this howl of hostages under moonlight in the garden of the sublime betrayers of our faith, this hot wind, this pedagogy of hate and indifference to the suffering, bodies piling up in secret numbers in the desert gloom no man's land, this subterfuge, this ancient history all over again, this death, this day, this long reaching back to home and the blunted, forsaken family, this boy full of promise and stupid glory, this town, this boy, this boy. It does sound like small arms fire. He's right. The country that we love. Before the stand that sold peaches and sweet corn in the summer, someone had stood up a mannequin dressed in a gold lamé bikini and red wig, with tiny American flags in each hand that undulated in the breeze. And I thought, isn't this the country that we love? Isn't this perspective of clouds deeper than usual, of vultures circling lazily in the distance as if at the end of a long tunnel? At the end of the day, it rains through some sunlight. Birds gather. They gather and swarm and make their biometric shapes against the white sky, and noisily stands the famous country of your brain. This book is called, by the way, The Abundance of Nothing. This manuscript, it's not yet a book. I've had some medical problems the last 3 years. I've had 4 brain surgeries in 3 years. And I wrote through all of it, and I felt at a certain point that I earned the right to write some sentimental dying poems. But I'm not going to read any of them to you because they're really pretty bad. But one of them I think maybe survived. It's called When I'm Gone. When I'm gone, I won't be here anymore. If you can imagine that, I can. I can imagine being gone and then being somewhere else, somewhere entirely different from this place, but with mist like at Dakto, only with softer greens and blues, and no small arms fired chatter in the untroubled trees, and no poison-tipped bamboo sticks. And when I'm gone, I would bequeath the space I had occupied to the dreamers and to the disenfranchised and to the lost singers of songs, so they might pitch their trash bag tents in peace and then ease back into the darkness that I love when I'm gone. It's called Beginning. I just glossed this poem a little. I was trying to write a poem about, I was trying to imagine somehow the moment that I might have become a writer, without, of course, without being aware of that at all. And I wrote several different types of poems trying to do that, all of which were unsuccessful. And I finally sort of let go of the idea and just let the poem speak to me. And this is what it said. I heard a voice in my head standing in the middle of a hurricane of leaves I was trying to rake into a pile to please my father into seeing that I could work like him. He laughed, then he picked me up, rake and all, and whisked me away into the warm coal furnace room of our family. The voice stayed there that night, and the voice said, "You don't belong here. This isn't your place." And I thought, how strange that of all the people in the neighborhood or in the city of all the people in the entire world, how strange that this voice would have chosen me to speak to and would have said that strange thing that it said. Belong where? I remember wondering to myself. I was where I was, and how could I be anywhere else? But I wanted to say great things then. I felt like I could stand up among my people and tell them the last story that they would ever need to hear. This is called wrong. In the sea of wrong and no way out, at 3 or 4, I lied the lie of omission when a crazy woman who lived in our apartment building confused my voice she listened to through the wall with a water glass with my sister's, about whom she imagined things we never understood. Wild, inexplicable deeds of a psychological nature unheard of in those days. One thing led to another until she pounded the door with her fist, her door or our door or both, it doesn't matter now, but then with some toy wooden bowling pins, so that my mother called my father from work, a thing I had never seen happen before in my life, and a gloom hung over everything. And I was just learning to tie my own shoes, and I asked my father to watch, but he pushed me aside, and at the back of the porch, he spoke to the crazy woman who had beat on the doors with her fists. He listened to her story quietly, and to her voice began to rise. I heard my sister's name called out in wild condemnation for words that I had said, and still in the wrong, I shuffled my feet in silence and looked up at some strange and miserable clouds blow in from the lake, changing everything. And I'd like to end with a poem for you. It's called Roses for the Reader. Thank you all so much for being here tonight. I want to give you these roses still cool from the florist. I want to give you these roses dying of their own beauty. I want you to watch them die. That's the point. This isn't story hour with Miss Nice Pants, after all. I want to stop lying. I want to give you these roses I stole from the grave of someone I did not love enough. Like the rest of us, they began to die the moment they were plucked from the earth. Another lie is that I want you to watch them die. I want you to crush them into your face because that's what you do with roses dying of our tenderness. Roses crushed all over your face. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I want to mention first that the poets will be signing their books in the lobby at the end of the reading, and that I've been crying, so if my voice does those funny things that tears do to a voice, that's why. I've read Brian say that it's very difficult to win awards for the poetry that comes out of the participation in a war. And just a day before I came here, I got a call from someone who's working with Chase Twitchell, the woman who edits Orsable Press. Who told me that Bruce had used some of the money from the Lannan Award to provide seed money for a clinic in Vietnam. So I wanted to begin by asking you about the relationship between the recognition that comes for doing this work and what provokes the work?
Provoking, I don't, it's hard. It seems like stuff comes up from inside, but then also, I feel sometimes like a farmer, kind of, going out and planting the seeds, waiting, and I don't know what's going to come up. A lot of times, it doesn't last very long. It dies, the poem doesn't work that well. But I think there's a lot of times I'll be in workshops, and sometimes I'll hear people say to like a person who wants to write, and they'll say, well, what advice do you have? And the advice oftentimes is to read a lot. Read, read, read. Which I think is great advice. But I also think it's related to me being in Ireland. I was in a bar late at night, and there was a band playing, and there were these girls that were dancing. They were about 12 or 14. They were the kids of the guitar player, and they were very proud of their dancing. Everybody was up there having a good time, and there were two New Yorkers sitting over on the side, and they had their notebooks out, and they were, like, taking notes, you know, like watching. And I walked over, and I was like, are you guys writers? And they're like, oh, yeah, we are. And I was like, oh, cool, good luck, you know. But I kind of felt like, you know, get out and live, you know, read too, but live your life, you know, be a part of life. And that's maybe the other part where it comes from, is seeing people being alive and doing what they do. The awards, though, it is problematic, as you'd mentioned, in some ways for me. With this particular one, maybe another book later, maybe I could let my ego kind of soak it in more or something. But then I get a call from somebody like Bosch, who shows up in this book, or he's a rifleman for me over there. He's now a sergeant, and I don't know. It's very problematic for me to sort of think that somehow what I've done I deserve any credit for, you know, that kind of. But on the other hand, artists, you know, it's hard to live to have your business card say poet or something. That's, you know. And the last year, I've been able to do that. I have a business card. It's cool. It says poet. I thought, I'm going to do that. You know, I'm a poet. And that's what I do. You know, so, and it's a very rare time. And it's in great thanks to many good folks here, the Lannan Foundation, and I was also other awards and stuff that were very helpful too. And it's a sort of balancing act with that whole thing.
Yeah, that was a real issue in my writing life. I was a graduate student in New Hampshire. I had a wonderful teacher, Charles Simic. And I started to question the fact that my art was based on the suffering of others. And I finally got up enough courage to tell him that, and that I told him that I decided that I didn't want to write about the American war in Vietnam anymore. And he sort of went like that to my forehead and said, look, you know, the worst thing in the world is a writer without a subject. And he said, you know, like it or not, this is the subject that the world gave you. And I think that what happened was it became an artistic struggle and not an emotional struggle anymore. So I think that that helped deal with it. But also I developed a new relationship with Vietnam. I started going back. So Vietnam became, early on for me, not a war, but a country. And I felt that it was important to share as much as I could about that experience and those people. They're inextricably bound to us, and we to them. And the more we know about them, I think, the better. They love Americans. Some people find that hard to believe, but they love our freedoms, and they love our independence and our sense of humor. And I wanted to celebrate some of that, so I got over it quickly.
I'm interested in what Brian just said about reading. Because when I was reading your poems just last night, I found a line from a Keats poem, the poem called "This Living Hand," and words from that poem, like "conscience calmed," turn up all over. And there's a poem that comes from Milton, and I wondered, because I know that like me, you don't come from a reading or writing family.
Yes.
And earning the right to own that stuff takes us most of our lives.
Absolutely.
You know, to enter the tradition of poetry.
I did a master's in writing after my undergraduate degree at Oberlin, and I realized I wanted to be a writer, but I realized I didn't know anything about literature. So that's what took me to my PhD studies. But we're allowed to steal. It's not called plagiarism. It's called going to the source of the fire. And I think I do give Keith credit, though, in the back of that book, don't I?
You might.
I think there's a footnote. As Michael said, I grew up in a house without books. My parents were not educated. My father didn't graduate from high school. None of my grandparents went to school. They're all immigrants. But what was present in that home and in that community was this great tradition of storytelling. And you had to earn your right to tell stories in that family. You didn't just start telling stories. You had to sort of be blessed and allowed to tell your story. And the stories from my grandparents were always so wonderful and otherworldly to me about this faraway country. And I think that's the most important part of my early literary training, more than Milton, more than Keats even. But it led naturally into Keats and Milton. It made sense to me. I think Keats and Milton made sense to me because of that background, because of those, you know, really vital, pared-down stories that my family would tell, for which I'm forever grateful. You know, I used to grieve my lack of the lack of culture in our family, and say I wish I'd grown up this way. You know, but I came to understand that I couldn't have had a better childhood to become a writer. At least the writer that I've become.
But what you say, Brian, about that makes me think about the importance of accessibility in poetry. That certainly not every reader reading the poems are going to say, oh, I love that Keats poem. No, of course not. A poem has to speak to you first. And then if you love poetry, you learn more and more about it. And my whole principle in doing that show that some of you listened to, Bookworm, it came from the fact that my parents sent me to college, and I felt like I had to be able to tell them what I learned when I was at school in a language that they would understand. You know, that something has happened, and the inaccessibility of a lot of modern work seems more important than its accessibility. Now that you're traveling around the country, reading and speaking to audiences, I think you must have the heaviest tourist schedule I've ever seen. What are you dealing with in terms of the making poetry accessible?
I've always believed that I could go back to grad school. I was writing these poems in workshops and stuff, and then I would take a bus, and I had to get a transfer. There was a bus station you had to get to go across town, and then I had my apartment. And I remember I would take the poems from the workshop, and I'd read them to people at the bus stop, you know, to see. And I wouldn't tell them which one was mine. I would just read poems just to see what was, you know, could people get it, like, could get something from it, or did they... Or they just give it, you know, the gong. No, that one doesn't work, you know. Because okay? People are brutally honest when they don't know. You're like, oh, that sucks, you know. You know, that kind of thing. Or you can tell they're trying to be nice to you, and then I know it's false nicety. So, you know, then I got my answer still, you know. So, and I always feel that from my vantage point is that a poem should welcome the reader into, or maybe in a very difficult way, but that there should be a world of the poem that's immediately the reader sort of enters into. And then if they want to later, like that first poem that I read where I said I continue to sort of go back to it, then there may well be layers and layers available there if they want to come back. But there should be a place to inhabit and live in first.
Do you know about the layers? When you're working, are those layers available to you, or do you discover them as you live in the poem and read it to people?
I think it's both, you know. Different poems work different ways, but I wrote one in a guard tower in Iraq, and I was consciously thinking of the skeleton of an ode structure underneath. So it didn't. If you look up an ode structure, you find Homeric or Pindaric odes or some certain syllable counts and things like that. I sort of threw that out the window, and I just had a basic structure that I tried to use in that poem. And then I was also in Al-Mabadi, Iraq, but in the poem, it looks over a city in Halabja in northern Iraq where it was gassed at one point. And you can look that up if you want to, but I was trying to put in the poem this other layer of, there's a moment at the very beginning of the poem where this lady's putting clothes on a clothesline and she's dressing the dead, basically. So when I put the Halabja in there, I was trying to make it possible for someone, if they wanted to, they could also read that these dead aren't just in this current war, but there are times past. There are other, you know, the dead are among us in many ways and from many times, you know, that kind of thing. So I was consciously thinking that while I was writing it, but I still wanted it initially for the person just to be able to inhabit the poem and see this woman dressing these invisible beings.
One of the poems, I think the one you just mentioned, begins with words. They're not translated. They're words to be said before one goes to sleep so that one sees the things one hopes to see in one's dreams. I thought, in a certain way, poetry is like that, you know, that the poetic state is somehow invoked by words that one might not understand in the hopes that what will be revealed is a thing that one has never been able before to say.
Do you mind? I don't know how this works exactly, this format, but I'd like to ask Bruce, sort of turning that, is it possible? There's when I write sometimes, I don't know how you, I wonder how you write sometimes with, when I approach a page, oftentimes I'll write a line or two lines, and then I'll keep repeating over and I'll say it out loud a lot. And I start, because it feels like it's starting to take root in the body, and I can feel it as a physical thing, not sort of just these conceptual words in your head. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Do you approach it a similar way? Do you read them out a lot as you're writing them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's very physical that way.
Yeah. Cool. I don't know how other people. I don't know. Maybe that strikes a chord with you. I don't know how you guys write when you approach the page. You know. So that's. I think.
But your work has a lot of invocation in it, and a lot of rhythms that are almost invoking the dead, invoking the spirit. More and more. Do you ride the poem's rhythm? Is that how it gets written?
You know, I've been a longtime student of prosody, and I love the English line, and I love the whole tradition of metrical poetry. Though I do write some traditional metrical poems, but you know, one of the great tragedies of American poetry is that when we shifted from a measured line to a free verse line, a lot of people had the idea that the line lost its importance. It didn't matter anymore. And I think I never believed that. I always thought that no matter what music you were hearing, that there still had to be that musical and conceptual integrity with regard to the line. So it's something that I think about a lot. Yeah, and doing it out loud is really the only way to do it. You know, that little Keats poem that you talk about, I don't know, do you know the poem?
This living hand, now warm and capable of earnest grasping, would, if it were cold and in the icy silence of the tomb, so haunt thy days and chill thy dreaming nights that thou wouldst wish thine own heart dry of blood, so in my veins red life might flow again and thou be conscience calmed. See, here it is. I hold it towards you.
Yeah, this was a poem that was discovered in the margins.
Tell the story.
Yeah, this is a poem that was discovered in the margins of scribbled in the margins of a long poem that Keats was working on called Cap and Bells. You know, he was struggling under this curse of having to sort of do the apprenticeship of the young poet in the face of Milton's great epic. And Keats struggled with this whole writing life and may have ruined him in some ways. And what he really wanted to do was write these short, intense lyrics like that. And just the gesture of that poem has always been so important to me as a writer.
Oh, but you're bringing up the huge subject here. Keats was writing that poem to a woman he loved his whole life who really wouldn't give him the time of day. Her name was Fanny Braun. And, you know, he essentially says to her, you know, I'll come back and haunt you after I'm dead. He used to be a very young poet, in fact. And, you know, he's saying, you know, you will regret.
Be nice to me now.
Be nice now. Be nice now. That's the only time we have. Be nice now. And but what about that sense of unrequited love? The pain that poets put in poems is not literary pain. It's an actual pain. We just, if we're lucky, find poets who word it better than we can.
Hey, he was 25 years old when he wrote that.
25 years old, yeah.
I don't know what to add right there. That was me. That's true. Yeah. The pain
I
and love,
find,
too, though.
Brian and I, both our generation, find ourselves in that same tradition in many ways. I think that it's fair to call us neo-romantics. Mm. I think that we have so much in common with them. And hearing Brian tonight, I was poignantly reminded of Wilfred Owen's poetry, thinking that this young man actually wrote these poems there in the war. I didn't write anything in Vietnam. I didn't write anything until I came home. I didn't know to write anything when I was there, but we have so much in common with that generation of poets, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, it seems to me. I just heard on the radio someone's been setting some of the Blake prophetic poems, and they sounded like both of yours, that we're living in a world where, you know, the prophecy of the apocalypse has become a necessity as part of the poetic equipment.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not sure about the romantic. It's odd. I think there's definitely a romantic impulse, but oftentimes, I think after the machine gun, in some ways, the hero has been changed dramatically in a lot of ways. I don't mean dramatically. It seems like the surreal for me fits more. And I hear that in your poetry as well. So I think some of these same threads are coming through, but the surreal seems to come up more than it did before, you know, because of that disillusionment with the hero and with ourselves as a country, right? You know.
Well, it's interesting. People reading your poems, and actually both of yours, now that I think of it, they start that business about surrealism, and yet, as far as surrealism goes, you guys are pikers. Surrealist poems, you know, really, you know, go into the ether. They're not to be written with consciousness at all. Sense is an unwelcome guest in a surrealist poem. So I don't think either of you use surrealist image techniques.
Yes.
But tell me about it. How do you develop an image? How does an image appear?
The last poem that I read at the farmer's market, I wrote that this week, and that was. But I've been sort of brewing for a couple weeks. I went down to the. I knew I wanted to write about a supermarket because I was thinking. I was thinking about how I'm here and I'm not in Iraq, but I get these emails from Iraq and from people that are still there that I worked with before. So the war seems like it's percolating up, you know, but at the same time, I don't really see it here and I don't really feel it. The only access or avenues to it are, you know, this television screen or these papers or maybe a conversation. And that conversation's been said so much no one wants to talk about it anymore because it's done. So art seems like maybe an avenue to get to this stuff in a different way. And so I went down to a supermarket, and I just took a notebook and I started writing notes of like finding words, you know, like kaboom and all and cheer and, you know, the avocados. I looked at them like, well, in a weird way, they kind of look like hand grenades, you know. And I started getting the raw material, and then I just sort of let it sit in my head. Like I said, I went out. I didn't go to a bar, but I didn't sit at the bar taking notes. I took my notes for a bit, and then I was going off doing things, but I let it sort of sit for a while and stewing on it here and there. And then this week, I started sort of diving into the poem. I'm trying really hard to sort of bring these two. So it is very much, as far as surrealism goes, in the image, you're trying to meld two worlds at the same time, that kind of move or movement.
Now, I'm curious. Listeners, you'll pardon me that I'm talking to these men as poets rather than as soldiers, because I think we know more about soldiering from television than we know about poetry. And I want to put the other information into the air. But it's unquestionable when you are reading a poem like the poem about the death of the boy from your town who died, we know where you stand about the war. You've chosen a more nonpartisan approach.
Seemingly nonpartisan.
Yeah. But nevertheless, I've read interviews with you in which you say that you've put this poem toward the end of the book in order not to alienate a conservative reader. So the concern about that kind of thing? Is the poet telling us what to think? I just want to hear the two of you discuss this between, you know, announcing, enunciating the stance, and perhaps burying it a little bit.
Yeah. I have to say, the first poem I read of Brian's, I was reading a copy of the Georgia Review. This was long before your book came out. I was just kind of leafing through it, and the title engaged me, and then I read the poem, and I was so struck by it that I made a copy of it, and I put it in my notebook so I would have it with me to read. And I thought, this is the voice that we need from this latest war. And then I learned a little bit more about Brian's background. And my first instinct was one of distrust, I have to say. I wondered, how could someone be educated and still go to the war that way? And it bothered me for a while. And then I read the book again, and I read it again. And I think what we're skating around here is really the genius of that book. It's that paradox that makes that book work. And that I think that, you know, we have to be careful not to confuse poetry with nonfiction prose, for example, that this is not Brian speaking to us in these poems. This is a persona that Brian creates to tell these stories. But I think that the fact that he went willingly made it all more difficult to write the poems that he wrote, to do the art that he did. Does that make sense?
I think, it was, well, not quite as willingly, but you know what I mean? There was it was very problematic. Was I going to get on that bird and go to the formation that would go? But I did go. So, you know, and there's a lot of complicity in that. And, but I'll get off target if I talk about that. But one of the things I'm hoping, for example, the poem Eulogy ends the first section of this book, and there's a section break, and there's a quote in there, but there were two quotes originally. One, the first one, so this guy is just taking a machine gun, put his mouth over the barrel, pushed down, and put about 6 to 8 rounds to the top of his skull. In the poem, he commits suicide, right? The very first quote of the second section is from President Bush, which says, quote, this crusade, this war on terror is going to last a while. Unquote. And that was my original quote. It's not in the book now. You won't find it there. And I took arguing with my editor. I think it was pretty savvy in a sense, and she convinced me because of the following reason, which was I didn't want to preach to the choir so much. The people I most wanted to affect are those who might not agree with me, you know, and I maybe they haven't been over there. Maybe it's you know, but there's still people who are. Part of our communities, and they might support what's happening. And I'm not sure if the news reports and editorial in the paper quite gets to the subject as much. I don't think the poems do completely either, but maybe it's one avenue that adds further to the larger dialogue, that kind of thing. So I wanted to really sort of, that's why I put the one that I thought crosses the line politically, that it's only in a subtle way. It's not even too overt that way, but at the end of the book, because I wanted to invite those people in I most disagree with, you know, perhaps politically. So, Can I add one thing, though?
Yes, please.
But Bruce is right on track when saying that when I was writing the poems, I was really writing to the moment and seeing things. This discussion I'm having now of how we're editing and way to putting poems and stuff together, that was later.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're totally right on that. Yeah, exactly.
Both of the wars in which you've participated are wars that Americans have felt uncertain about why we were there. Norman Mailer wrote a whole book, the lamented and recently departed Norman Mailer, wrote a whole book called Why Are We in Vietnam? It was a novel, and I don't think anyone knew any better by the time they finished reading that novel. But I've wondered, these wars whose reasons and goals we haven't been made aware of, do you, as writers, as you write, do you come to know why we're there? Do these questions ever become answerable?
I think maybe this relates even to the last question. One thing I really like about Bruce and I read, the first time I got to warm up to stage was in Chicago, and it was a joy because I've read his books, you know, from college on, and but I was struck by when he first came up, he did something that I'm not seeing many poets do here in America, and I think, and I hate to sort of condemn, but I think they need to be doing this, and that is talking about the war. Being very upfront about it. And I really admired how you used the F word and you said, hey, we got to start paying attention to this stuff and that kind of thing. And it was it was a good wake-up call to wake people up. What's that?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. Thank you. And now I'm forgetting the title because I just remember in the moment and I was really glad to see an author do that. A lot of writers here maybe don't feel, and I had this problem a little bit too because I'm not in the war now, but there's this call to authority, like, well, do I have street cred? Was I there? Can I write about it? And a lot of people here didn't go there, probably for very good reasons, and or not. I don't know, but they feel like they don't have the voice to talk. You know what I mean? But that's, we have to help frame the discussion. We have to be part of the discussion.
I'm more confused than ever about it. It's completely beyond my understanding how we can continue to do what we do there. I teach a class called Great Books, which is a two-semester class that begins with Homer and ends with the 21st century. And I've been teaching this class for 10 years, and one of the things that's occurred to me is that every culture, every era has its war. And each one of those cultures writes about their war as if it were an anomaly. Mm-hmm. And you know, I wonder how long is it going to be an anomaly? How long before we say, this is really part of who we are? This is one of the things as human beings that we do. I don't know if there's an answer to why we do it. I mean, there are some political answers, obviously. But even those, who knows? It certainly wasn't because there were weapons of mass destruction to be removed from the country. We know that for sure. I think that it was about the oil is too easy an answer. I think that the pathology of the president is much more complicated and insidious than that. Mm. So that... So that I don't have an answer.
You know, the second poem of my book touches on the oil, too, because it mentions in there, it's talking about the Baghdad Zoo and all the animals and stuff were sort of roaming through the city as the war was taking place, the initial invasion. And if you talk to many Iraqis in the cities and stuff, they can tell you that the tanks rolled past them, rolled past their banks with their life savings. They rolled past the police stations, the schools, the museums, and they went to the Ministry of Oil, which was dumb. There was nothing really there but paperwork, right? And they circled them. And it was easy enough to see, oh, for at least in many people's minds. And they haven't forgotten that. It might be easy for us here in America because we have so many issues that continue to take us moment by moment. But I don't have the answer to these wars either, but and along the lines of what you'd said, Bruce, is that I heard that there was a historian that tried to calculate, I don't know if he was correct, but in human history, of recorded history, there's about 29 years of peace, and I'm still wondering, debating that myself, and I'm wondering if the historical record is missing some things. But but I think maybe, I don't think we can have an answer for the why we're at war or to stop it necessarily, but maybe we can just put enough pressure so we won't go into Iran, for example, right now. Things like that, you know what I mean? That maybe that can be part of the conversation to stave off as much war as possible.
So how do you exert that pressure?
By being here. I promised the guys when I was in Iraq, I promised, you know, Tony and David and Tom, Fiorillo, Bosch, and Jakowski in the book, but I promised them that I'd be on a street corner or wherever I could be to talk about this stuff. So, you know.
Yeah, I would add that. The Lannan Foundation has done so much in supporting these voices of dissent. I think that in many cases my politics hurt me as a writer, hurt my career. And this is one example where it didn't, where I think that it was considered favorable, was considered the right way to. But thanks to them, that they bring to the public these voices of dissent. That's another way. And look, we're sitting in a room full of people here who care about this enough to be here tonight.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wouldn't be fair if I didn't thank the Lannan Foundation, too, because, no one knew me as anything until they knew me as something. I mean, there barely wasn't Michael Silverblatt, and they gave me the opportunity to become him, for which I'm very grateful. But I want to kind of close by asking. See, I didn't know you were going to ask me to recite this Living Hand, but it is sitting very close to the front of my frontal lobe at all times. And I get worried. I think...
I was disappointed that you knew it, because I wanted to say it.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. And I was afraid... Okay, yeah. I really didn't want to show off like that. Okay, but the deal here is, I think, one of the ways that poetry helps us and literature helps us is that when we're memorizing a poem, we are in some way civilizing the mind. Mm-hmm. And that if we don't memorize the poem or read the book, that's why when you say, you know, about the read, and get out and live, I think the get out and live stuff is important and great for a writer, but I think for the world, the more time people spend reading, the less time they're spending fighting. And the more time they're spending domesticating whatever that mystery thing is you mentioned that makes us go to war, that makes it part of human nature, that somehow or other the human imagination is able to curb and curtail it from moment to moment, mm-hmm. if it can. And that while we're here tonight, just think of what else we aren't doing, you know, what darksome things we don't participate in while we sit here. And, you know, it's perhaps that reason why I only really feel safe among readers. I mean... But can poetry help, even in that reverse way of keeping us away from the killing fields?
I think it could do even more than that, too. It can add, it's a conversation we can have with people who are no longer here, you know? Like that poem that you read, it was a nice way of bridging that yeah. discussion, you know? There's so many, Keats is still alive, you know?
Yeah. So... I couldn't have said it any better than you just said it, so. Mm. I feel safe among readers, too, that way. I feel safe in the poem. I feel inside the poem.
Mm-hmm. Well, when a book is like this.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what the book does. It protects you from all of that stuff out there. Yeah.
Yes, and we need the protection. It is not safe to lose it. And if we ever do, we'll be an unhappier culture, although it seems that we might be on our way toward that loss. Do you think so?
I think so.
I'm afraid so.
Unfortunately.
I'm not sure. I'm still... My vote's out still. I haven't cast that vote yet. Yeah. I see... They talk about the death of poetry as often comes up. It seems like every generation. But it seems to be still alive. You know, there's people... We got Bruce, you know?
The criticism that I remember getting a lot early on, and I'm sure Brian has heard this too, is why are your poems so depressing? Why are you writing about such awful things all the time? And what I understood early on, even before I could articulate it, was that the gesture of writing the poem is to defeat the horror. It's the human gesture. It's to rise above the horror and to rise above the pain and the suffering and the loss. So that you own yourself again. You take charge of your experience. It no longer is in charge of you, crushing you into the ground.
The way blues players play the blues, right? Not to cry, but to celebrate.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank both of you and all of you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.